3, 2, 1. The fuel blended with oxygenates promises to reduce winter air pollution in Fairbanks and Anchorage, but the cost of that fuel has Fairbanks residents taking notice. Estimates have been as high as 25 cents more for a gallon of gas. Ron King with the Department of Environmental Conservation says the latest figure he has is a 15-cent a gallon increase, an average of $5 to $10 more a month. But King says it's still not certain what the cost will be.
The market is just so variable right now. Prices are actually indicating higher than what was believed 2 years ago, in the neighborhood of up to 8 cents a gallon, although the demand and the market size in Lower 48 may affect that price and bring it down.
Fairbanks officials have been doing some checking of their own. Borough Mayor Jim Sampson says other states and communities already using oxygenated fuels have not seen a big increase in price. Sampson says oil refiners need to keep in mind that consumers will want justification for any big increase.
When you have people look at other programs and some of those costs in the implementation of oxy fuels is an average of 3 cents a gallon, when one hears 15 to 20 to 25, they're not happy about that. And there needs to be a justification, good justification of those prices. And if not, I think you're going to see some widespread discontent.
Sampson and other elected officials met with the DEC last week to express concerns about the new oxygenated fuel program. The city had two violations of the air emissions program last year, and some officials here think that oxygenated fuels will be more trouble than it's worth. But the state believes that the new fuels will bring the city into compliance with the Clean Air Act by 1995. As for the concern over prices, Ron King says now that it's required for 39 communities, demand is exceeding supply. King says about the only thing the DEC can do is request an audit.
Well, at this point, we'll watch what is happening as it's starting to be marketed in comparison with the prices in the Lower 48. And at that point, if there appears to be anything unusual, then we'll begin a deeper investigation and audit if necessary.
Gas retailers will sell the new oxygenated fuels from November 1st through March 1st. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. One recommendation you may have already heard about is a school tax. It would be one half of 1% of your pay. But it's only one of the many ideas addressing educational standards, school funding and construction, teachers, technology, and school choice. One idea not included is a voucher system where public funds could be used to pay for a school parents choose. Committee members who had worked on Alaska 2000 say vouchers would not pass a constitutional challenge. But Mark Kissel with the State Department of Education says another recommendation involving parental choice would be charter schools.
Well, it's just another way of introducing choice into the public school system. It doesn't have anything to do with supporting private schools with public money. But what it does have to do with is allowing parents and teachers to form a contract school with their local board of education that might be aimed at a certain group of students, might be aimed at students who are interested, let's say, in mathematics in particular or science in particular. And it's a way of interjecting more choice into the public school system.
Kissel says one of the most talked about parts of the plan is designating student performance standards, explaining what students need to know before they can graduate. Another is changing teacher tenure so it would not be permanent, but subject to renewal after 7 years. Several of the recommendations deal with paying for public education. Besides the school tax, there are some plans to change how the system is funded now. Mark Kissel says they all call for some funding at a local level.
A couple reasons for that. I think the main one is they felt that in order for a community to feel ownership and involvement in their public schools, they needed to have actual ownership in terms of supporting that with their money. There's also recommendations advanced that the state pay the entire cost of what's called a basic education, that is the education necessary to meet the performance standards. Anything else that a community wants to add to that will have to be paid by that community.
Alaska 2000 also calls for $100 million for school construction projects to pay for the backlog of building needs in the state. The Alaska 2000 recommendations cover a range of ideas, some that might move forward and others that won't. The State Board of Education wants to get started and recommend the ideas that have the widest public support. They'll go to the governor and then on to legislative consideration this spring. Recommendations have been publicized in the state's newspapers. Tonight's hearing from 7 to 10 at the Old University Park School follows the one in Anchorage last week. In October, teleconferences are scheduled in several rural Alaska communities to hear more about Alaska 2000. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Because of the Clean Air Act, 39 communities will have to use oxygenated fuels this winter. Their carbon monoxide emissions violate air quality standards. Fairbanks is one of those communities, with two violations each of the last two winters. The state backs the introduction of oxygenated fuels, so Fairbanks will meet the clean air standards in the next 3 years. Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Manager Ron King believes that combined with the vehicle inspection and maintenance program, oxyfuels will make the difference.
Based on the current models we have for evaluation, the oxygenated fuels program is, with the vehicle inspection program, going to bring Fairbanks into attainment. But that's all, I have to stress, based on models, not the actual atmosphere conditions. And so there is some room for error in there.
If Fairbanks does not meet the EPA clean air standards, King says there are more far-reaching steps to be concerned about. But some Fairbanks officials think it's a lot of trouble for a problem the community has made steady progress addressing already through the vehicle inspection and maintenance program. And Borough Assemblyman Harold Gillum says he wants to know more about the oxygenate that's being used. Methyl tertiary butyl ether, MTBE.
Nobody has been able to tell me what the products of combustion of this MTBE are. And we're not talking a small quantity of MTBE in the gasoline. We're talking 15%. So that's quite a bit, and we should know what the products of combustion are, and we should know what those products of combustion are at the low temperatures that we achieve here. I think we're going to see a strong increase in aldehydes. That means we're trading a carbon monoxide non-problem for an aldehyde, which is a known carcinogen.
Then there's the cost of the new fuel. Now that it's required, demand is exceeding supply. The DEC's Ron King says the latest estimate is that gas will increase about 15 cents a gallon, adding up to between $5 and $10 more a month for the average driver. But Borough Mayor Jim Sampson says other states using oxygenated fuels now haven't seen that kind of price increase. He says consumers will be watching, and gas refiners should be ready to explain their costs.
When you have people look at other programs, and some of those costs in the implementation of oxyfuels is an average of 3 cents a gallon, when one hears 15 to 20 to 25, they're not happy about that. And there needs to be a justification, a good justification of those prices, and if not, I think you're going to see as I indicated to the commissioner this evening, you're going to see some widespread discontent.
Oxygenated fuels might not be a permanent winter feature in Fairbanks. DEC officials hope that if the community meets the clean air requirements, the oxygenated fuels program may go away. But Fairbanks officials doubt it. The IM program has almost achieved compliance, but that program not only isn't going away, now the EPA wants to see it improved. Since the Clean Air Act requires an air quality plan from the state and not the borough, some local officials think maybe the whole thing should be turned over to the state. Mayor Sampson says that's not his intention, but considering the cost the community will have to pick up, the community wants to see the benefits.
There is an argument that perhaps local government is closest to the people, but if we have a program that continues to be structured in a way that the local governing body has no involvement or no say as to what what the criteria of the program is, then it's going to lose any support it has. And I don't think anybody in the assembly disagrees with the need for clean air, but I think they just need to have a little bit more justification and why these things are needed when you only exceed the limits one or two times a year.
Sampson is working on an air quality plan the borough will submit to the state. Then the state can submit its plan to the EPA. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. Since some mental health trust land has already been sold and developed, the settlement calls for available state lands to be substituted, like land in Cook Inlet, where oil and gas leases are held by Marathon and Unocal oil companies. Attorneys for the mental health trust beneficiaries staked a claim to it. Now the oil companies are challenging that in court. Attorney Peter Mawson says the oil companies made their lease deals with the state, not the mental health land trustees, and that's how they want to keep it.
It really puts a damper on business when the oil companies don't know from 1 year to the next who the lessor is going to be. If these leases are suddenly transferred to the mental health trust, which has a mandate which we don't really understand, things could really be different, and it's hard for them to plan on development.
Mawson also says the mental health trust plaintiffs aren't entitled to the oil company's confidential information about that land. The oil company's action is the type of thing that plaintiff's attorney Philip Volan says he was afraid would happen under the settlement. Volan never signed on to the agreement and wants the court to throw it out. Another plaintiff's attorney in Fairbanks last week for the hearing, Jeff Jeffy, says he's not sure he could recommend it to his clients anymore.
I think that the length of the litigation that it's going to involve, the increased negative publicity for beneficiaries because of the additional holding up of lands and interfering with people's ideas of what they want to do with land in the state is something that we hadn't anticipated when we passed the law. And propose the settlement. And so now I think everyone's going to have to take a look at just what the real cost is of going at the settlement this way.
But the state still thinks it's a good settlement, and so does another plaintiff's attorney, Jim Gottstein. Gottstein says it shouldn't have come as a surprise that proposed substitute land would include tracts in Cook Inlet. Gottstein testified in court that it's a good settlement.
Because it achieves virtually everything that the trust can get in litigation, plus a little bit, probably. It does it a lot sooner than it would otherwise. I think settling litigation generally is good. With respect to the state, it certainly disentangles the thousands of parties that have gotten their properties tied up in this litigation.
At this stage, Superior Court Judge Mary Green is taking an initial look at the settlement. She just heard testimony last week. Arguments on the merits of the settlement will be heard later. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3-2-1. Attorneys who worked out the settlement with the state were called to the witness stand. Also testifying was former Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Harold Hines, who ran that department when the settlement was drafted and still supports it. But Philip Voland represents mental health plaintiffs who don't like the deal. He says it doesn't solve the problem or end the litigation, since the solution to substitute other state lands for the original trust lands is creating problems.
The plaintiffs in the case are caught up in litigation from environmental interveners, from oil companies. The process of selection, which requires the individuals who are selecting the trust to take only the most valuable land in any of the state's inventory, requires them to take actions that are inherently antagonistic to other development interests in the state.
Volan says returning to the original litigation is more acceptable to him, and another plaintiff's attorney, Jeff Jesse, says he's not so sure he could recommend the settlement to his clients anymore. Jesse testified that the deal might not look as good now as it did last year, but another plaintiff's attorney, Jim Gottstein, says it's still a good deal.
Because it achieves virtually everything that the trust can get in litigation, plus a little bit, probably. It does it a lot sooner than it would otherwise. I think settling litigation generally is good. With respect to the state, it certainly disentangles the thousands of parties that have gotten their properties tied up in this litigation.
But while properties in the original mental health land trust might be untied under the settlement, it's the proposed lands to be substituted getting attention now. Marathon and Unocal have filed a motion to intervene in the case. The mental health plaintiffs proposed Cook Inlet oil and gas leased property as substitute trust land. That means mental health plaintiffs could have access to confidential oil company information, which the oil companies argue violates state law. They want the court to declare that the trust does not have a claim on the Cook Inlet leases. At this stage, Superior Court Judge Mary Green is taking an initial look at the settlement. She just heard testimony Thursday and Friday. Arguments by all the attorneys involved on the merits of the settlement will be heard later. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. There are two ballots for the primary, gold and blue. If you want to choose among only the Republican candidates, you'll get a gold ballot. On the blue ballot, you'll find Democratic, Green, and Alaskan Independence Party candidates. The reason for the change goes back to 1990. That's when Republican Party member Bonnie Williams says the Republicans decided they don't want Democrats choosing their nominees.
The purpose of a primary is for members of a political party to select who shall be their standard bearer, to select their candidates. And that being the case, it doesn't make sense to run a primary election in which members of other political parties do the selecting for you.
So today, Alaska has what's called a classic open primary. Williams expects a lot of voter confusion, not just because of the primary change, but also because of all the new election district boundaries created by reapportionment. What may be even more confusing is that even though the Republicans wanted the change so that only Republicans and nonpartisan or undeclared voters can vote Republican, today it doesn't really matter how you're registered to vote. Anyone can choose the open ballot, and if you want the Republican ballot, you can change your party affiliation and get it. Election supervisor for the Fairbanks area, Shelley Groudon, says you have to choose which ballot you want.
There are sample ballots at the polling places. They can pick up a sample ballot for their district, see which candidates are in which ballot, and then make a determination over which ballot they want to vote. A voter can only be issued one type of ballot. You don't get both an open ballot and the Republican ballot.
Groudon says based on an early look at the absentee ballots that have been turned in, more voters are choosing the open ballot than the Republican ballot.
I can just see, you know, go through the ballots that we've been receiving through the mail and voters voting in person at my absentee voting station. I can get an idea from those ballots that I have been reviewing, and a good number of them are the open ballot, and just a small number have been the Republican ballot.
Regardless of party affiliation, Groudon says voters who requested an absentee ballot in the mail had to indicate that they wanted the Republican ballot or they were mailed the open ballot. Groudon says the Elections Division has received lots of phone calls on the primary change, and people who are unhappy have been referred to Bonnie Williams. Williams says she's had from 50 to 100 phone calls about it. She says when she explains the change, most people are satisfied, but she doesn't know what it will mean at the polls today.
I don't know what to expect on how many people will vote the Republican ballot as opposed to the other ballot. I know what I expect people will do in the general election, and that's what they always do. They don't vote party, they vote candidate. They're going to go for who they think is the best, regardless of party.
Many voters have also received their new voter ID card in the mail by now. That information will help officials when you go to vote today, but you don't have to have that card in order to vote. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. Three, two, one. Only 24 votes separate school board incumbent Jerry McBeth from challenger Bob Boko, and McBeth is trailing in that count. Borough clerk Mona Drexler says the race will likely be decided by absentee ballots.
We'll be counting those on Friday night. I think that absentees and questions will definitely decide school board seat C. I don't think that race will be decided until the questions and absentees are counted.
Another close race is for a Fairbanks City Council seat, where Randall Wallace leads by about 100 votes. One closely watched contest last night was the race between Donna Gilbert and Valerie Therrien for Borough Assembly. It was a rematch of the election 3 years ago when Gilbert defeated the incumbent Therrien. This time, the roles were reversed, with Therrien pulling off the win over Donna Gilbert. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. In one of the more closely watched races, the margin of victory for Valerie Therrien was wider than might have been imagined. Therrien defeated one-term incumbent Donna Gilbert to win her old seat back on the Borough Assembly. Therrien got 44% of the vote to Gilbert's 38%. The third candidate, Dan Lasota, polled 11% of the voters. Sarian was at the borough building as the numbers came in.
When I got out on the corner this morning at 7:30 and it wasn't freezing, and when I hit the bridge at 11:45 and the sun was shining and it was about to hit 50, I just felt that the turnout was going to be really good, and if the weather was good and the turnout was good, I thought I was going to win the election.
In other assembly contests, Harold Gillum and Hank Bartos retained their seats. Each got more than 50% of the vote in their race. The fourth race for borough assembly turned out to be the closest. Political newcomer Nancy Jones edged school board president Gene Redden for that seat on the assembly. Jones earned 42% of the vote to Redden's 39%. Jones was one of the happiest people in the room.
Oh, I'm just so ecstatic. I'm still levitating. This is just unbelievable. It's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I mean, really. I mean, normally you submit a resume to an employer and it's between you and an employer and maybe they have a panel of people interviewing you, but it's nothing like submitting a resume to the entire borough like I've been doing, you know, for the past almost 40 days. This is just so exciting.
The races for Fairbanks City Council turned out to be fairly close as well. Randall Wallace beat Mary Hadukovich by a little more than 100 votes. Dennis Hedgecock trailed by 500 votes there. And Bob Ely was reelected to a 3-year term on the council, beating his closest challenger, Lynn House, by 500 votes. Jim Hayes was unopposed in his bid for city mayor. The borough will institute a hotel-motel tax. Voters supported an 8% bed tax by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. Borough Clerk Mona Drexler was very happy with the voter turnout in most cases.
We had many precincts today that turned out in over 50%, and very many that turned out in over 45%. If we had not had a couple of precincts that had a 15% turnout, our turnout would show a very good voting turnout for this election. I'm very pleased with the voter turnout in almost all the precincts.
Absentee ballots and the ballots of people who voted outside their precincts, called question ballots, will all be counted on Friday night. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Yes, I was worried about Bonnie. Bonnie's a good candidate, and she's worked hard and done a lot of things, and I have a lot of respect for Bonnie. And I didn't think I'd win this big, but I am pleasantly surprised.
We knew that it'd be a close race. It was a good, clean race. We stuck to the issues. My opponents, Mary and Dennis, both stuck to the issues. It was all of us were glad to see that. And it's looking good now. Nothing's sewn up until the absentees are counted. But we feel good about it.
3, 2, 1. The Techite litigation evolved for 5 years before the case was thrown out last week. Federal Judge Clarence Newcomer ruled that Fairbanks did not have the evidence to show Amoco misrepresented the product or that the city relied directly on Amoco's presentation and was hurt as a result. The city hired attorney Joe Evans to work on the Techite case several years ago. Evans blames part of last week's court loss on the fact that a new judge from out of state had to catch up on a complicated case quickly, and Evans believes the judge incorrectly applied standards for fraud that are different in Alaska.
The law in Alaska, frankly, on fraud and misrepresentation is more beneficial to the party that's been defrauded than the law in Pennsylvania and the law, frankly, in other states.
Of the original 6 complaints filed against Amoco, Evans says fraud is perhaps the most difficult to prove, but it was the only one left for the city's attorney to pursue. Before Newcomer was assigned the case, Judge Andrew Kleinfeld handled it first. Evans says Kleinfeld dismissed the city's express and implied warranty complaints against Amoco.
The city had discovered that it might have potential warranty claims in August of 1986, but waited until September of 1987 when it filed its lawsuit to give Amoco notice of the warranty breaches or warranty claims. Judge Kleinfeld felt that 13 months was too long to wait to give notice of breach of the warranty claims.
After Kleinfeld's ruling a few years ago, the city was still left with what Evans says may have been the easier claims to prove, product liability and negligence. But when Kleinfeld was appointed to a higher court, Judge James Singleton took over the federal judgeship here. Evan says Singleton ruled against those claims 6 months ago.
Judge Singleton dismissed those two claims because he felt that the statute of limitations had run on those claims. That is, that the city did not bring those claims in a timely enough fashion. And the city's position is that the products claim and the negligence claim survive because the reason we didn't bring those was because of the fraudulent concealment of our problems.
Despite those rulings, Evans still feels the city can win. He says they have the evidence to show that the Tekite pipe was not suitable and that Amoco should have known that. It's just a matter of getting it before a jury. Evans says he'll be taking the options before the city council when it considers an appeal.
The decision on whether or not to appeal really has been made in the sense that the council wants to appeal but wants to see what are the grounds, what's the cost, and what are our chances on appeal.
It could be more than a year before the city would know the outcome of an appeal. If the city cannot get money for replacement pipe from Amoco, it would have to come up with the more than $30 million to pay for the replacement pipe itself. So far, nearly $6 million has been spent on legal and expert advice in the Tekite case. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
The building was secured by the military, and the people were not allowed in to the building. And when people started to gather outside to get into the building, they said, you can't vote, you can't go in the building, so people left. And many people did not go back. The power was off for 2 hours. And that time from 4:30 to 6:30 is the time when most people got off work. And once they were turned away from the polls, they left.
Three, two, one. It's only been open 1 week, but the new non-alcoholic lounge called Little Darlings is getting a lot of free publicity. If the place served alcohol, it would only be open to anyone over 21. But since it doesn't, people as young as 18 can go in and see dancers take off their clothes. Charles McLeod owns the neighboring Good News Bible and Bookstore. He told the city council Monday night that he's already found empty liquor bottles around his building.
The place is supposed to be non-alcoholic, but you and I know that if you can't get it inside, you're going to bring it with you and drink it outside. And that will cause other problems.
But an employee of Little Darling says the place is simply filling a need in the community and giving people who aren't old enough to go to bars some place to hang out. And Lindsay Cooper says as for the dancers, they're just part of the entertainment, not the main attraction.
They can come to our bar, shoot some pool, have a Coke, whatever. We serve non-alcoholic beer. They can have a beer, you know, with no alcohol in it. Have a beer, you know. We do have some dance. We have a few dancers. Watch, you know, the girls dance on stage, you know. Play pool and just have a good time.
Cooper arrived at City Hall after the council meeting was over. She tends bar at Little Darlings and calls it a bar even though no alcohol is served. Cooper says there is a bouncer at the door to make sure patrons are at least 18. There's no cover charge, but customers have to buy at least one drink. Cokes are $4. Cooper says it's not a trashy place and does not attract a negative crowd.
It's a really nice atmosphere. And for mothers that think that their son shouldn't be in there, you know, you have to look at what today's youth is faced with. And they can be there or they can be at some big keg party around a bonfire drinking beer, getting drunk, and being influenced by drugs and stuff. And we don't have that going on in our bar. You know, and if we did find out that anything like that was going on in our bar, it would stop immediately, and we'd call the police, and charges would be pressed, you know. So I think it is a rather nice teen hangout.
Some parents have protested against the new lounge. They don't want 18-year-olds allowed where strippers perform. They want the city to take action against the club, but even if the council can't shut it down, neighboring businessman Don Weldon says he wants them to be watching.
I'm here as a citizen to hope, to be steadfast with my neighbors and saying that when they do something illegally, and they will, that the city will be right there to close them down.
Members of the city council want more information about what can be done. But the city attorney says at this point, legally, there's nothing the city can do to shut down Little Darlings. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. 3, 2, 1. The city council has indicated support for the new taxes. Without them, they don't know how they'll pay to keep the fire department running. Jerry Cleworth is the only one expressing opposition at this point. He believes any new taxes are subject to voter approval. Cleworth thinks if the council goes ahead and passes these taxes, voters will start a petition drive, and they'll be subject to a special election anyway. Now new questions are being raised on just how much money the taxes will bring in. They were originally proposed as retail taxes, and the city manager estimated that the city would see more than $1 million a year. Now the council is pushing a distribution tax, so wholesalers will pay the 8% tax on any alcohol and tobacco that Fairbanks retailers buy from them. One wholesaler, Dan O'Connor with Alaska Distributors, says in a letter to the council that a wholesale distribution tax will mean less money for the city, since wholesale prices are lower than retail. For example, O'Connor estimates the distribution tax on a case of beer would give the city about $1.50, while a retail tax on the same case would be more than $5. For hard liquor, the difference is even greater, $8 for the city based on wholesale costs versus $66 at retail. City Council Member Mike Andrews is the sponsor of the new tax ordinances. Andrews says they may not yield as much as the city originally hoped, but he says the accounting will make the tax much easier to collect. There are only about a dozen wholesalers, while there are more than 100 retailers. Andrews doesn't think the city will lose money under the wholesale tax and believes it's still the best way to go.
I support the distribution tax because it's a better way to collect the tax. It's easier on the small businesses, and it also would give us a strong figure on what we can expect for revenue for the city. It won't hurt us as far as revenue goes for 1993 and could possibly increase revenue.
Retail liquor sellers didn't want to see their tax increased, and Club Manchu owner Larry Hackenmiller says changing to a distribution tax will mean less paperwork for him. But Hackenmiller told the city council he doesn't like the fact that the city only plans to suspend the retail tax, not repeal it.
What do we have? Do we have a 5% retail tax, or do we have an 8% wholesale tax, or a distribution tax? And I would request that that be taken out. Either that or just drop the entire matter and just leave it as is.
Hackenmiller says if the new taxes are approved, he'll work to see that only one tax remains on the books. So far, the tobacco wholesalers have not had much to say about the new 8% tax on their product. City officials say that will be a real money raiser for the city, since it's estimated to bring in more than $500,000 during its first year. And in the midst of these tax discussions, lingers talk of a general sales tax. Those who don't think the city should raise money through sin taxes talk more and more about a general sales tax, which city voters continually have turned down. The alcohol and tobacco taxes are up for City Council approval on Monday night. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I'll just go after someone that I think would be an asset. It's got to be someone that's positive, and I think by rights I should confer with Mike. It's his seat. He ran for it. He ran hard. He won. He certainly brings a certain expertise to the council. Some people view the city council as a big hot seat. They think, you guys are always in the news, you're always, people are always on you, there's always a dispute. Well, I think that's good to a certain degree. I think it makes good government.
3, 2, 1. With refueling help from the Alaska Air National Guard, Eielson sent aircraft, people, and support equipment to Elmendorf Air Force Base near Anchorage. But the crew simulated a mission overseas to show Eielson can handle short-term deployments self-sufficiently. Commander Colonel Tom Fleming says they've always been able to run such missions, but until the Air Guard made some changes, Fleming says they had to count on military help from outside Alaska.
We've always relied on other national-level assets to be provided to help us move from point A to point B. We can move our airplanes, but we can only fly so far without air refueling from people like the 168 and we cannot move our people other than the pilots of the airplanes themselves without outside help.
Fleming says taking on a mission with a crew based solely from Eielson means the military can get where it's needed when it's needed. The head of the Air Guard's 168th Refueling Group, Colonel Doug Clinton, says before, the Guard wasn't available to do these kinds of missions without a presidential call-up. But with changes made since the end of the Cold War, the Guard can now be ready to go anytime.
Our mission in the past has been under the former Strategic Air Command, was to project a bomber force primarily in a nuclear war. That's all changed now, and our primary focus is more in a tactical nature, and that's being able to deploy to various areas all over the globe, anywhere that we might be needed, take the fighter assets along with us, and be able to fight when we get there.
The mission involved more than 250 people, 8 F-16 fighter planes, 4 A-10s, and 4 KC-135 cargo tankers. The Air Force says the amount of people and equipment that the cargo planes allowed them to take enabled the crews to make it possible to go anywhere for 10 days. Master Sergeant Dick Hardy was part of the Air Guard crew. Hardy usually refuels the planes, but says the cargo made this mission different.
It's still a practice, but at least it's a little more realistic than just the daily missions. We very seldom load cargo, so we actually uploaded their cargo, took it down to Anchorage, and then offloaded and uploaded today and brought it back home.
Even though this flight was only to Anchorage, Air Force Colonel Tom Fleming says they'll take more trips now to learn to do the job better. But Fleming says distance is not the important thing.
99% of the difficulty of this is not in how far you go, but in packaging up and taking off and being able to demonstrate the ability to go. We were simulating a deployment to Europe in this case, and the 168th indeed had the assets to transport us all the way to Europe if it had that been our desire. The fact that we landed 250 miles away instead of 2,500 or 3,500 miles away was merely our choice.
Fleming says last week's mission offers a look at the future use of air power for the Pacific Air Forces. They can be deployed worldwide from Eielson Air Force Base. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Only a few people turned out to protest the new taxes to the council Monday night. Some have already told council members their objection to the new taxes, arguing that drinkers and smokers will pay for the services everyone receives. The council has been threatened with legal action or a possible voter referendum to repeal the taxes. But frequent council critic Donna Gilbert says the Interior Taxpayers Association won't be leading the opposition.
If you pass this action tonight without a vote of the people, ITA will not be doing a referendum on either of these ordinances tonight. It does not mean as individuals that people will not become involved in it. It is our understanding that these issues will be going to court. We don't feel that that's our place to take it to court. We do feel that you're circumventing the intent of the tax cap.
Council members also heard warnings from one of their own. Councilmember Jerry Cleworth says it's a violation of the city charter to approve new city taxes without getting approval from the voters first. Cleworth urged council members to put the taxes up on an election ballot. They turned down that request.
I showed to the council the city charter, specifically the items on tax cap, which talks about a cap on municipal taxes only being raised by a vote of the people. They ignored that, which puzzles me no end. I don't understand that.
Cleworth says he opposes these new taxes because the council has failed to control expenses, failed in labor negotiations, and is still paying salaries that are too high. The sponsor of the ordinance, Councilman Mike Andrews, says the city might not need the money now if the council had acted differently in the past. Andrews cites the decision to merge the police and fire departments 2 years ago. The resulting lawsuit has cost the city more than $800,000 in legal fees. Andrew says he believes city residents support these new taxes and hopes the 5-1 council vote in favor of them gets backed by the public, despite Cleworth's concerns.
Councilman Cleworth has a pretty good argument, but I don't think it's a good enough argument as far as the tax cap goes, or our city manager, our revenue commission, our mayor, and our city attorney wouldn't allow us to go forward with this. We haven't heard enough yet to convince us that we should stop and put this to a ballot or do something about the tax cap on property.
Andrew says he hasn't heard many complaints about the new taxes. Councilmember Donna Lewis says the people she talks to support them, but they didn't come to the meeting to testify. The city wants the new taxes so that the fire department can continue to operate without the additional $1 million they're expected to bring in. City leaders say they only have enough money to run the department through the end of June. The council did pass one other money-raising idea, sponsored by Jerry Cleworth. This one would go to a city ballot. It asks for voter approval of a property tax increase to pay for street repair and snow removal. That will be voted on in October or at a special election if one is called first. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
We'll be here with posters and answering folks' questions. We also have application forms and let them know generally what's coming down the pike, and we would like their input. Because everybody has good ideas. We need to listen and see what the people want, get together, because we're Alaskans. We agree to disagree. He will buy the time on ABC, NBC, CBS. The entire U.S. public can have a shot at it, not just United We Stand America. We're jump-starting it. We're putting the fuel in the engine. We need all the help we can get. When it's in place, everybody has a voice. Elected officials can run, but they can't hide. The facts will show up on the screen and either acknowledge the people or the people will do what's right for the people.
And we used to raise $50,000 to $100,000 a year after everything was paid for. And it's my intention, the city needs revenues. The parking meters are a revenue source. New projection indicates that we'll make about $160,000 in the first year. It would be, I think that figure is probably a little high, but I think it'll raise at least $100,000 in the first year. Gives us another uniformed police officer on the street, even though that isn't a sworn officer, isn't a gun-carrying officer. That enforcement officer does carry a radio, has a City of Fairbanks police uniform. It's another presence in the downtown area, too. I go downtown myself, and I'm in a stop-and-go business as a salesman, and I have less problems finding a parking place with the parking meters than I do now. I found it easier back when the parking meters were here. And again, city's looking for revenue. That's where we need to be.
3, 2, 1. In newspaper and television ads, they said it's not about wolves, but about states' rights. By the looks and sound of the crowd Wednesday night, hunters are the main supporters of the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Alliance. Wearing buttons saying, "I love moose meat and wolf management, not wolf worship," they encouraged people upon arrival to sign petitions supporting wolf control. Spokesman Lynn Levengood says they believe game resources must be managed on a sound basis, not by politics. As the rally started, Levengood warned that people might disrupt the proceedings, but the only disruptions were shouts of support from the crowd of about 400. Among the main speakers was Fairbanks car dealer Ralph Seekins, who is also scheduled to speak at the Wolf Summit. Seekins says hunters have had to compromise too much over the years.
Every compromise seems to cost us, but not them. They never give back an inch of what they took. And we're nice guys. We give it to them. Well, I'm one of those who say that right now is the time to draw the line in the snow. I'm not going to be pushed any farther.
After Seekins spoke, former Board of Game member Samantha Castle told the crowd she finds it depressing that the state is still talking about wolf control after 3 decades. But she says the good news is that there are still wildlife resources to talk about. She urged those who plan to attend the Wolf Summit to listen to others with respect and courtesy, as she plans to. Dave Vandenberg with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center attended the rally and says he was impressed by the number of people who turned out. Vandenberg says it was educational, and he was glad to hear moderating tones from some of the speakers.
Several of the speakers had a real moderate tone and said, you know, this process well, we should not consider that this process is over. And it's okay to continue to talk and have dialogue and share ideas. And that, you know, that really is our fundamental position, is that this issue can only be resolved in everyone's best interest if it's done by Alaskans and for Alaskans.
The Wildlife Conservation Association has just started its efforts and plans to draw more attention during the Wolf Summit. Lynn Levengood says they raised $10,000 in 2 days to kick off the campaign. They'll place another newspaper ad and hold picket signs at hotels and the airport on Friday. They'll hold another rally on Saturday morning outside the Wolf Summit. They're also encouraging supporters to wear hunter orange jackets, hats, or armbands as a sign of solidarity. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The new group calling itself the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Association promoted the rally in full-page newspaper ads, saying it's not about wolves, but about who manages Alaska. A member of the group, Fairbanks car dealer Ralph Seekins, says it's a vital issue.
Many of us are tired of being treated like a colony and having our affairs managed by public opinion polls.
Seekins says hunters have had to compromise too much and sound game management practices are needed. The group plans to picket the airport and local hotels before the Wolf Summit begins to get their message out. They're also encouraging supporters to wear hunter orange jackets, caps, or armbands to show solidarity. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.